would have become of me, for I couldn't have borne the business alone. But she was a magnificent monument to the blessing of a want of imagination, and if she could see in our little charges nothing but their beauty and amiability, their happiness and cleverness, she had no direct communication with the sources of my trouble. If they had been at all visibly blighted or battered, she would doubtless have grown, on tracing it back, haggard enough to match them. As matters stood, however, I could feel her when she surveyed them, with her large white arms folded and the habit of serenity in all her look, thank the Lord's mercy that if they were ruined, the pieces would still serve. Flights of fancy gave place in her mind to a steady fireside glow, and I had already begun to perceive how, with the development of the conviction that, as time went on without a public accident, our young things could, after all, look out for themselves, she addressed her greatest solicitude to the sad case presented by their instructress. That, for myself, was a sound simplification. I could engage that to the world my face should tell no tales, but it would have been, in the conditions, an immense added strain to find myself anxious about hers. At the hour I now speak of, she had joined me, under pressure, on the terrace, where, with the lapse of the season, the afternoon sun was now agreeable, and we sat there together while before us at a distance, but within call if we wished. The children strolled to and fro in one of their most manageable moods. They moved slowly, in unison, below us, over the lawn, the boy, as they went, reading aloud from a storybook and passing his arm round his sister to keep her quite in touch. Mrs. Groves watched them with positive placidity. Then I caught the suppressed intellectual creak with which she conscientiously turned to take from me a view of the back of the tapestry. I had made her a receptacle of lurid things, but there was an odd recognition of my superiority, my accomplishments and my function in her patience under my pain. She offered her mind to my disclosures as, had I wished to mix a witch's broth and proposed it with assurance, she would have held out a large clean saucepan. This had become thoroughly her attitude by the time that, in my recital of the events of the night, I reached the point of what Miles had said to me when, after seeing him at such a monstrous hour, almost on the very spot where he happened now to be, I had gone down to bring him in, choosing then at the window, with a concentrated need of not alarming the house, rather that method than a signal more resonant. I had left her, meanwhile, in little doubt of my small hope of representing with success, even to her actual sympathy, my sense of the real splendour of the little inspiration with which, after I had got him into the house, the boy met my final articulate challenge. As soon as I appeared in the moonlight on the terrace, he had come to me as straight as possible, on which I had taken his hand without a word and led him through the dark spaces up the staircase where Quint had so hungrily hovered for him, along the lobby where I had listened and trembled, and so to his forsaken room. Not a sound on the way had passed between us, and I had wondered, oh, how I had wondered, if he were groping about in his little mind for something plausible and not too grotesque. It would tax his invention, certainly, and I felt, this time, over his real embarrassment, a curious thrill of triumph. It was a sharp trap for the inscrutable. He couldn't play any longer at innocence, so how the deuce would he get out of it? There beat in me, indeed, with the passionate throb of this question, an equal dumb appeal as to how the deuce I should. I was confronted at last, as never yet, with all the risk attached, even now, to sounding my own horrid note. I remember, in fact, that as we pushed into his little chamber, where the bed had not been slept in at all, and the window, uncovered to the moonlight, made the place so clear that there was no need of striking a match, I remember how I suddenly dropped, sank upon the edge of the bed from the force of the idea that he must know how he really, as they say, had me. He could do what he liked, with all his cleverness to help him, so long as I should continue to defer to the old tradition of the criminality of those caretakers of the young who minister to superstitions and fears. He had me, indeed, and in a cleft stick, for who would ever absolve me? Who would consent that I should go unhung if, by the faintest tremor of an overture, I were the first to introduce into our perfect intercourse an element so dire? No, no. It was useless to attempt to convey to Mrs. Groves, just as it is scarcely less so to attempt to suggest here how, in our short, stiff brush in the dark, he fairly shook me with admiration. I was, of course, thoroughly kind and merciful. Never, never yet had I placed on his little shoulders hands of such tenderness as those with which, while I rested against the bed, I held him there well under fire. I had no alternative but, in form at least, to put it to him. "You must tell me now, and all the truth. What did you go out for? What were you doing there?" I can still see his wonderful smile, the whites of his beautiful eyes, and the uncovering of his little teeth shine to me in the dusk. "If I tell you why, will you understand?" My heart, at this, leapt into my mouth. Would he tell me why? I found no sound on my lips to press it, and I was aware of replying only with a vague, repeated, grimacing nod. He was gentleness itself, and while I wagged my head at him, he stood there more than ever a little fairy prince. It was his brightness, indeed, that gave me a respite. Would it be so great if he were really going to tell me? "Well," he said at last, "just exactly in order that you should do this."
"Do what?"
"Think me, for a change,
bad."
I shall never forget the sweetness and gaiety with which he brought out the word, nor how, on top of it, he bent forward and kissed me. It was practically the end of everything. I met his kiss, and I had to make, while I folded him for a minute in my arms, the most stupendous effort not to cry. He had given exactly the account of himself that permitted least of my going behind it, and it was only with the effect of confirming my acceptance of it that, as I presently glanced about the room, I could say, "Then you didn't undress at all?" He fairly glittered in the gloom.
"Not at all. I sat up and read."
"And when did you go down?"
"At midnight. When I'm bad, I am bad."
"I see, I see. It's charming. But how could you be sure I would know it?"
"Oh, I arranged that with Flora."
His answers rang out with a readiness.
"She was to get up and look out."
Which is what she did do. It was I who fell into the trap.
"So she disturbed you, and to see what she was looking at, you also looked, you saw."
"While you," I concurred, "caught your death in the night air." He literally bloomed so from this exploit that he could afford radiantly to assent.
"How otherwise should I have been bad enough?" he asked.
Then after another embrace, the incident and our interview closed on my recognition of all the reserves of goodness that for his joke he had been able to draw upon. 12. The particular impression I had received proved in the morning light, I repeat, not quite successfully presentable to Mrs. Groves, though I reinforced it with the mention of still another remark that he had made before we separated. "It all lies in half a dozen words," I said to her, "words that really settle the matter."
"Think, you know, what I might do.
He threw that off to show me how good he is. He knows down to the ground what he might do. That's what he gave them a taste of at school."
"Lord, you do change," cried my friend. "I don't change. I simply make it out. The four, depend upon it, perpetually meet. If on either of these last nights you had been with either child, you would clearly have understood. The more I've watched and waited, the more I've felt that if there were nothing else to make it sure, it would be made so by the systematic silence of each. Never, by a slip of the tongue, have they so much as alluded to either of their old friends, any more than Miles has alluded to his expulsion.
Oh, yes, we may sit here and look at them, and they may show off to us there to their fill. But even while they pretend to be lost in their fairy tale, they're steeped in their vision of the dead restored. He's not reading to her, I declared. They're talking of them. They're talking horrors. I go on, I know, as if I were crazy, and it's a wonder I'm not. What I've seen would have made you so. But it has only made me more lucid, made me get hold of still other things. My lucidity must have seemed awful, but the charming creatures who were victims of it, passing and repassing in their interlocked sweetness, gave my colleague something to hold on by, and I felt how tight she held, as without stirring in the breath of my passion, she covered them still with her eyes.
Of what other things have you got hold?
Why, of the very things that have delighted, fascinated, and yet at bottom, as I now so strangely see, mystified and troubled me. Their more than earthly beauty. Their absolutely unnatural goodness. It's a game, I went on. It's a policy and a fraud.
On the part of the little darlings?
As yet mere lovely babies? Yes, mad as that seems. The very act of bringing it out really helped me to trace it, follow it all up and piece it all together. They haven't been good. They've only been absent. It's been easy to live with them because they're simply leading a life of their own. They're not mine, they're not ours, they're his and they're hers.
Quince and that woman's.
Quince and that woman's. They want to get to them. Oh, how at this poor Mrs. Groves appeared to study them.
But for what?
For the love of all the evil that in those dreadful days the pair put into them. And to ply them with that evil still, to keep up the work of demons, is what brings the others back.
Laws, said my friend under her breath.
The exclamation was homely, but it revealed a real acceptance of my further proof of what in the bad time, for there had been a worse even than this, must have occurred. There could have been no such justification for me as the plain assent of her experience to whatever depth of depravity I found credible in our brace of scoundrels. It was in obvious submission of memory that she brought out after a moment.
They were rascals, but what can they now do?
She pursued.
Do?
I echoed so loud that Miles and Flora, as they passed at their distance, paused an instant in their walk and looked at us.
Don't they do enough?
I demanded in a lower tone, while the children, having smiled and nodded and kissed hands to us, resumed their exhibition. We were held by it a minute. Then I answered, they can destroy them. At this my companion did turn, but the inquiry she launched was a silent one, the effect of which was to make me more explicit. They don't know as yet quite how, but they're trying hard. They're seen only across, as it were, and beyond, in strange places and on high places, the top of towers, the roof of houses, the outside of windows, the further edge of pools, but there's a deep design on either side to shorten the distance and overcome the obstacle, and the success of the tempters is only a question of time. They've only to keep to their suggestions of danger.
For the children to come
and perish in the attempt. Mrs. Groves slowly got up, and I scrupulously added, unless, of course, we can prevent. Standing there before me while I kept my seat, she visibly turned things over.
Their uncle must do the preventing. He must take them away.
And who's to make him? She had been scanning the distance, but she now dropped on me a foolish face.
You, miss!
By writing to him that his house is poisoned and his little nephew and niece mad?
But if they are, miss?
And if I am myself, you mean? That's charming news to be sent him by a governess whose prime undertaking was to give him no worry. Mrs. Groves considered, following the children again.
Yes, he do hate worry. That was the great reason
why those fiends took him in so long. No doubt, though his indifference must have been awful. As I'm not a fiend, at any rate, I shouldn't take him in. My companion, after an instant, and for all answer, sat down again and grasped my arm.
Make him, at any rate, come to you?
I stared.
To me?
I had a sudden fear of what she might do.
Him? He ought to be here. He ought to help.
I quickly rose, and I think I must have shown her a queerer face than ever yet. You see me asking him for a visit? No, with her eyes on my face, she evidently couldn't. Instead of it, even as a woman reads another, she could see what I myself saw. His derision, his amusement, his contempt for the breakdown of my resignation at being left alone, and for the fine machinery I had set in motion to attract his attention to my slighted charms. She didn't know. No one knew. How proud I had been to serve him and to stick to our terms. Yet she nonetheless took the measure, I think, of the warning I now gave her. If you should so lose your head as to appeal to him for me... She was really frightened.
Yes, miss?
I would leave on the spot both him and you. 13. It was all very well to join them, but speaking to them proved quite as much as ever an effort beyond my strength, offered in close quarters difficulties as insurmountable as before. This situation continued a month, and, with new aggravations and particular notes, the note above all, sharper and sharper, of the small, ironic consciousness on the part of my pupils. It was not, I am as sure today as I was sure then, my mere infernal imagination. It was absolutely traceable that they were aware of my predicament, and that this strange relation made in a manner for a long time the air in which we moved. I don't mean that they had their tongues in their cheeks or did anything vulgar, for that was not one of their dangers. I do mean, on the other hand, that the element of the unnamed and untouched became between us greater than any other, and that so much avoidance could not have been so successfully effected without a great deal of tacit arrangement. It was as if, at moments, we were perpetually coming into sight of subjects before which we must stop short, turning suddenly out of alleys that we perceived to be blind, closing with a little bang that made us look at each other, for like all bangs it was something louder than we had intended, the doors we had indiscreetly opened. All roads lead to Rome, and there were times when it might have struck us that almost every branch of study or subject of conversation skirted forbidden ground. Forbidden ground was the question of the return of the dead in general and of whatever in especial might survive in memory of the friends little children had lost. There were days when I could have sworn that one of them had, with a small invisible nudge, said to the other,
"She thinks she'll do it this time, but she won't."
To do it would have been to indulge, for instance, and for once in a way, in some direct reference to the lady who had prepared them for my discipline. They had a delightful, endless appetite for passages in my own history, to which I had again and again treated them. They were in possession of everything that had ever happened to me, had had, with every circumstance, the story of my smallest adventures, and of those of my brothers and sisters, and of the cat and the dog at home, as well as many particulars of the eccentric nature of my father, of the furniture and arrangement of our house, and of the conversation of the old women of our village. There were things enough, taking one with another, to chatter about if one went very fast and knew by instinct when to go round. They pulled with an art of their own the strings of my invention and my memory, and nothing else, perhaps, when I thought of such occasions afterward, gave me so the suspicion of being watched from under cover. It was, in any case, over my life, my past, and my friends alone, that we could take anything like our ease, a state of affairs that led them sometimes, without the least pertinence, to break out into sociable reminders. I was invited, with no visible connection, to repeat afresh Goody Gosling's celebrated mot, or to confirm the details already supplied as to the cleverness of the vicarage pony. It was partly at such junctures as these, and partly at quite different ones, that with the turn my matters had now taken, my predicament, as I have called it, grew most sensible. The fact that the days passed for me without another encounter ought, it would have appeared, to have done something towards soothing my nerves. Since the light brush that second night on the upper landing of the presence of a woman at the foot of the stair, I had seen nothing, whether in or out of the house, that one had better not have seen. There was many a corner round which I expected to come upon Quint, and many a situation that, in a merely sinister way, would have favoured the appearance of Miss Jessel. The summer had turned, the summer had gone. The autumn had dropped upon Bligh, and had blown out half our lights. The place, with its grey sky and withered garlands, its bared spaces and scattered dead leaves, was like a theatre after the performance, all strewn with crumpled playbills. There were exactly states of the air, conditions of sound and of stillness, unspeakable impressions of the kind of ministering moment that brought back to me, long enough to catch it, the feeling of the medium in which, that June evening out of doors, I had had my first sight of Quint, and in which, too, at those other instants, I had, after seeing him through the window, looked for him in vain in the circle of shrubbery. I recognised the signs, the portents. I recognised the moment, the spot. But they remained unaccompanied and empty, and I continued unmolested, if unmolested, one could call a young woman whose sensibility had, in the most extraordinary fashion, not declined but deepened. I had said in my talk with Mrs. Groves on that horrid scene of Flora's by the lake, and had perplexed her by so saying, that it would from that moment distress me much more to lose my power than to keep it. I had then expressed what was vividly in my mind, the truth that whether the children really saw or not, since, that is, it was not yet definitely proved, I greatly preferred, as a safeguard, the fullness of my own exposure. I was ready to know the very worst that was to be known. What I had then had an ugly glimpse of was that my eyes might be sealed just while theirs were most opened. Well, my eyes were sealed, it appeared, at present, a consummation for which it seemed blasphemous not to thank God. There was, alas, a difficulty about that. I would have thanked him with all my soul, had I not had, in a proportionate measure, this conviction of the secret of my pupils. How can I retrace today the strange steps of my obsession? There were times of our being together when I would have been ready to swear that literally in my presence, but with my direct sense of it closed, they had visitors who were known and were welcome. Then it was that had I not been deterred by the very chance that such an injury might prove greater than the injury to be averted, my exultation would have broken out. "They're here! They're here, you little wretches!" I would have cried, "and you can't deny it now!" The little wretches denied it with all the added volume of their sociability and their tenderness, in just the crystal depths of which, like the flash of a fish in a stream, the mockery of their advantage peeped up. The shock, in truth, had sunk into me still deeper than I knew on the night when, looking out to see either Quint or Miss Jessel under the stars, I had beheld the boy over whose rest I watched and who had immediately brought in with him, had straightway there turned it on me, the lovely upward look with which from the battlements above me the hideous apparition of Quint had played. If it was a question of a scare, my discovery on this occasion had scared me more than any other, and it was in the condition of nerves produced by it that I made my actual inductions. They harassed me so that sometimes, at odd moments, I shut myself up audibly to rehearse. It was at once a fantastic relief and a renewed despair, the manner in which I might come to the point. I approached it from one side and the other, while in my room I flung myself about, but I always broke down in the monstrous utterance of names. As they died away on my lips, I said to myself that I should indeed help them to represent something infamous, if by pronouncing them I should violate as rare a little case of instinctive delicacy as any schoolroom probably had ever known. When I said to myself, "They have the manners to be silent, and you, trusted as you are, the baseness to speak," I felt myself crimson, and I covered my face with my hands. After these secret scenes, I chattered more than ever, going on volubly enough, till one of our prodigious, palpable hushes occurred. I can call them nothing else. The strange, dizzy lift or swim, I try for terms, into a stillness, a pause of all life, that had nothing to do with the more or less noise that at the moment we might be engaged in making, and that I could hear through any deepened exhilaration or quickened recitation or louder strum of the piano. Then it was that the others, the outsiders, were there. Though they were not angels, they passed, as the French say, causing me, while they stayed, to tremble with the fear of their addressing to their younger victims some yet more infernal message or more vivid image than they had thought good enough for myself. What it was most impossible to get rid of was the cruel idea that whatever I had seen, Miles and Flora saw more, things terrible and unguessable, and that sprang from dreadful passages of intercourse in the past. Such things naturally left on the surface for the time, a chill which we vociferously denied that we felt, and we had all three, with repetition, got into such splendid training that we went each time, almost automatically, to mark the close of the incident, through the very same movements. It was striking of the children, at all events, to kiss me inveterately, with a kind of wild irrelevance, and never to fail, one or the other, of the precious question that had helped us through many a peril. "When do you think he will come? Don't you think we ought to write?" There was nothing like that inquiry, we found by experience, for carrying off an awkwardness. He, of course, was their uncle in Harley Street, and we lived in much profusion of theory that he might at any moment arrive to mingle in our circle. It was impossible to have given less encouragement than he had done to such a doctrine, but if we had not had the doctrine to fall back upon, we should have deprived each other of some of our finest exhibitions. He never wrote to them. That may have been selfish, but it was a part of the flattery of his trust of me. For the way in which a man pays his highest tribute to a woman is apt to be but by the more festal celebration of one of the sacred laws of his comfort, and I held that I carried out the spirit of the pledge given not to appeal to him when I let my charges understand that their own letters were but charming literary exercises. They were too beautiful to be posted. I kept them myself. I have them all to this hour. This was a rule, indeed, which only added to the satiric effect of my being plied with the supposition that he might at any moment be among us. It was exactly as if my charges knew how almost more awkward than anything else that might be for me. There appears to me, moreover, as I look back, no note in all this more extraordinary than the mere fact that in spite of my tension and of their triumph, I never lost patience with them. Adorable they must in truth have been, I now reflect, that I didn't in these days hate them. Would exasperation, however, if relief had longer been postponed, finally have betrayed me? It little matters, for relief arrived. I call it relief, though it was only the relief that a snap brings to a strain, or the burst of a thunderstorm to a day of suffocation. It was at least change, and it came with a rush. 14. Walking to church a certain Sunday morning, I had little Miles at my side and his sister in advance of us and at Mrs. Gross's, well in sight. It was a crisp, clear day, the first of its order for some time. The night had brought a touch of frost, and the autumn air, bright and sharp, made the church bells almost gay. It was an odd accident of thought that I should have happened at such a moment to be particularly and very gratefully struck with the obedience of my little charges. Why did they never resent my inexorable, my perpetual society? Something or other had brought nearer home to me that I had all but pinned the boy to my shawl, and that in the way our companions were marshalled before me I might have appeared to provide against some danger of rebellion. I was like a jailer with an eye to possible surprises and escapes. But all this belonged, I mean their magnificent little surrender, just to the special array of the facts that were most abysmal. Turned out for Sunday by his uncle's tailor, who had had a free hand and a notion of pretty waistcoats and of his grand little heir, Miles's whole title to independence, the rights of his sex and situation, were so stamped upon him that if he had suddenly struck for freedom, I should have had nothing to say. I was, by the strangest of chances, wondering how I should meet him when the revolution unmistakably occurred. I call it a revolution because I now see how, with the word he spoke, the curtain rose on the last act of my dreadful drama, and the catastrophe was precipitated.
"Look here, my dear, you know," he charmingly said. "When in the world, please, am I going back to school?"
Transcribed here, the speech sounds harmless enough, particularly as uttered in the sweet, high, casual pipe with which, at all interlocutors, but above all at his eternal governess, he threw off intonations as if he were tossing roses. There was something in them that always made one catch, and I caught, at any rate, now so effectually that I stopped as short as if one of the trees of the park had fallen across the road. There was something new, on the spot, between us, and he was perfectly aware that I recognised it, though, to enable me to do so, he had no need to look a whit less candid and charming than usual. I could feel in him how he already, from my at first finding nothing to reply, perceived the advantage he had gained. I was so slow to find anything that he had plenty of time after a minute to continue with his suggestive but inconclusive smile.
"You know, my dear, that for a fellow to be with a lady always—"
His "my dear" was constantly on his lips for me, and nothing could have expressed more the exact shade of the sentiment with which I desired to inspire my pupils than its fond familiarity. It was so respectfully easy. But oh, how I felt that at present I must pick my own phrases— I remember that, to gain time, I tried to laugh, and I seemed to see in the beautiful face with which he watched me how ugly and queer I looked.
"And always with the same lady?" I returned.
He neither blanched nor winked. The whole thing was virtually out between us.
"Ah, of course. She's a jolly, perfect lady. But after all, I'm a fellow, don't you see? That's, well, getting on."
I lingered there with him an instant ever so kindly. "Yes, you're getting on."
Oh, but I felt helpless.
I have kept, to this day, the heart-breaking little idea of how he seemed to know that and to play with it.
"And you can't say I've not been awfully good, can you?"
I laid my hand on his shoulder, for though I felt how much better it would have been to walk on, I was not yet quite able. "No, I can't say that, Miles."
"Except just that one night, you know?"
"That one night, I couldn't look as straight as he."
"Why, when I went down, went out of the house?"
"Oh, yes, but I forget what you did it for."
"You forget?"
He spoke with the sweet extravagance of childish reproach.
"Why, it was to show you I could."
"Oh, yes, you could."
"And I can again."
I felt that I might, perhaps, after all, succeed in keeping my wits about me. "Certainly, but you won't."
"No, not that again. It was nothing."
"It was nothing," I said. "But we must go on." He resumed our walk with me, passing his hand into my arm.
Then when am I going back?
I wore, in turning it over, my most responsible air.
Were you very happy at school?
He just considered.
Oh, I'm happy enough anywhere.
Well then, I quavered, if you're just as happy here...
Ah, but that isn't everything. Of course you know a lot.
But you hint that you know almost as much, I risked as he paused. Not half I want to, Miles honestly professed.
But it isn't so much that.
What is it then?
Well, I want to see more life.
I see. I see. We had arrived within sight of the church and of various persons, including several of the household of Bly, on their way to it, and clustered about the door to see us go in. I quickened our step. I wanted to get there before the question between us opened up much further. I reflected hungrily that for more than an hour he would have to be silent, and I thought with envy of the comparative dusk of the pew and of the almost spiritual help of the hassock on which I might bend my knees. I seemed literally to be running a race with some confusion to which he was about to reduce me. But I felt that he had got in first when, before we had even entered the churchyard, he threw out,
"I want my own sort."
It literally made me bound forward. "There are not many of your own sort, Miles," I laughed. "Unless perhaps dear little Flora."
"You really compare me to a baby girl?"
This found me singularly weak.
"Don't you then love our sweet Flora?" "If I didn't, and you too, if I didn't,"
he repeated, as if retreating for a jump, yet leaving his thought so unfinished that after we had come into the gate, another stop, which he imposed on me by the pressure of his arm, had become inevitable. Mrs. Groves and Flora had passed into the church, the other worshippers had followed, and we were, for the minute, alone among the old, thick graves. We had paused on the path from the gate by a low, oblong, table-like tomb. "Yes, if you didn't?" He looked while I waited at the graves.
"Well, you know what."
But he didn't move, and he presently produced something that made me drop straight down on the stone slab as if suddenly to rest.
"Does my uncle think what you think?"
I markedly rested. "How do you know what I think?"
"Ah, well, of course I don't, for it strikes me you never tell me. But I mean, does he know?"
"Know what, Miles?"
"Why, the way I'm going on."
I perceived quickly enough that I could make, to this inquiry, no answer that would not involve something of a sacrifice of my employer. Yet it appeared to me that we were all at Bly sufficiently sacrificed to make that venial. "I don't think your uncle much cares." Miles, on this, stood looking at me.
"Then don't you think he can be made to?"
"In what way?"
"Why, by his coming down?"
"But who'll get him to come down?"
"I will," the boy said with extraordinary brightness and emphasis. He gave me another look, charged with that expression, and then marched off alone into church.
15. The business was practically settled from the moment I never followed him. It was a pitiful surrender to agitation, but my being aware of this had somehow no power to restore me. I only sat there on my tomb and read into what my little friend had said to me the fullness of its meaning. By the time I had grasped the whole of which, I had also embraced, for absence, the pretext that I was ashamed to offer my pupils and the rest of the congregation such an example of delay. What I said to myself above all was that Miles had got something out of me, and that the proof of it, for him, would be just this awkward collapse. He had got out of me that there was something I was much afraid of, and that he should probably be able to make use of my fear to gain for his own purpose more freedom. My fear was of having to deal with the intolerable question of the grounds of his dismissal from school, for that was really but the question of the horrors gathered behind. That his uncle should arrive to treat with me of these things was a solution that, strictly speaking, I ought now to have desired to bring on. But I could so little face the ugliness and the pain of it that I simply procrastinated and lived from hand to mouth. The boy, to my deep discomposure, was immensely in the right, was in a position to say to me, "Either you clear up with my guardian the mystery of this interruption of my studies, or you cease to expect me to lead with you a life that's so unnatural for a boy." What was so unnatural for the particular boy I was concerned with was this sudden revelation of a consciousness and a plan. That was what really overcame me, what prevented my going in. I walked round the church, hesitating, hovering. I reflected that I had already, with him, hurt myself beyond repair. Therefore I could patch up nothing, and it was too extreme an effort to squeeze beside him into the pew. He would be so much more sure than ever to pass his arm into mine and make me sit there for an hour in close, silent contact with his commentary on our talk. For the first minute since his arrival, I wanted to get away from him. As I paused beneath the high east window and listened to the sounds of worship, I was taken with an impulse that might master me, I felt, completely, should I give it the least encouragement. I might easily put an end to my predicament by getting away altogether. Here was my chance. There was no one to stop me. I could give the whole thing up, turn my back and retreat. It was only a question of hurrying again for a few preparations to the house which the attendants at church of so many of the servants would practically have left unoccupied. No one, in short, could blame me if I should just drive desperately off. What was it to get away if I got away only till dinner? That would be in a couple of hours, at the end of which I had the acute prevision. My little pupils would play at innocent wonder about my non-appearance in their train.
"What did you do, you naughty bad thing? Why in the world to worry us so and take our thoughts off too, don't you know? Did you desert us at the very door?"
I couldn't meet such questions, nor, as they asked them, their false little lovely eyes. Yet it was all so exactly what I should have to meet that as the prospect grew sharp to me, I at last let myself go. I got, so far as the immediate moment was concerned, away. I came straight out of the churchyard, and thinking hard, retraced my steps through the park. It seemed to me that by the time I reached the house I had made up my mind I would fly. The Sunday stillness, both of the approaches and of the interior, in which I met no one, fairly excited me with a sense of opportunity. Were I to get off quickly, this way, I should get off without a scene, without a word. My quickness would have to be remarkable, however, and the question of a conveyance was the great one to settle. Tormented in the hall, with difficulties and obstacles, I remember sinking down at the foot of the staircase, suddenly collapsing there on the lowest step, and then with a revulsion, recalling that it was exactly where more than a month before, in the darkness of night and just so bowed with evil things, I had seen the spectre of the most horrible of women. At this, I was able to straighten myself. I went the rest of the way up. I made, in my bewilderment, for the schoolroom, where there were objects belonging to me that I should have to take. But I opened the door to find again, in a flash, my eyes unsealed. In the presence of what I saw, I reeled straight back upon my resistance. Seated at my own table in clear noonday light, I saw a person whom, without my previous experience, I should have taken at the first blush for some housemaid, who might have stayed at home to look after the place, and who, availing herself of rare relief from observation, and of the schoolroom table and my pens, ink and paper, had applied herself to the considerable effort of a letter to her sweetheart. There was an effort in the way that, while her arms rested on the table, her hands, with evident weariness, supported her head. But at the moment I took this in, I had already become aware that, in spite of my entrance, her attitude strangely persisted. Then it was, with the very act of its announcing itself, that her identity flared up in a change of posture. She rose, not as if she had heard me, but with an indescribable, grand melancholy of indifference and detachment, and within a dozen feet of me stood there as my vile predecessor. Dishonoured and tragic, she was all before me, but even as I fixed and for memory secured it, the awful image passed away. Dark as midnight in her black dress, her haggard beauty and her unutterable woe, she had looked at me long enough to appear to say that her right to sit at my table was as good as mine to sit at hers. While these instants lasted, indeed, I had the extraordinary chill of feeling that it was I who was the intruder. It was as a wild protest against it that actually addressing her, "You terrible, miserable woman!" I heard myself break into a sound that by the open door rang through the long passage and the empty house. She looked at me as if she heard me, but I had recovered myself and cleared the air. There was nothing in the room the next minute but the sunshine and a sense that I must stay. 16. I had so perfectly expected that the return of my pupils would be marked by a demonstration that I was freshly upset at having to take into account that they were dumb about my absence. Instead of gaily denouncing and caressing me, they made no allusion to my having failed them, and I was left, for the time, on perceiving that she too said nothing, to study Mrs. Groves's odd face. I did this to such purpose that I made sure they had in some way bribed her to silence, a silence that, however, I would engage to break down on the first private opportunity. This opportunity came before tea. I secured 5 minutes with her in the housekeeper's room, where, in the twilight, amid a smell of lately baked bread, but with the place all swept and garnished, I found her sitting in pained placidity before the fire. So I see her still, so I see her best, facing the flame from her straight chair, in the dusky, shining room, a large, clean image of the put-away, of drawers closed and locked, and rest without a remedy.
"Oh, yes, they asked me to say nothing, and to please them, so long as they were there, of course I promised. But what had happened to you?"
"I only went with you for the walk," I said. "I had then to come back to meet a friend." She showed her surprise.
"A friend? You?"
"Oh, yes, I have a couple," I laughed. "But did the children give you a reason?"
"For not alluding to your leaving us? Yes, they said you would like it better. Do you like it better?"
My face had made her rueful. "No, I like it worse." But after an instant I added, "Did they say why I should like it better?"
"No. Master Miles only said, we must do nothing but what she likes."
I wish indeed he would. And what did Flora say?
Miss Flora was too sweet. She said, oh, of course, and I said the same.
I thought a moment. You were too sweet too. I can hear you all. But nonetheless, between Miles and me, it's now all out.
All out? My companion stared. But what, miss?
Everything. It doesn't matter. I've made up my mind. I came home, my dear, I went on, for a talk with Miss Jessel. I had by this time formed the habit of having Mrs. Groves literally well in hand, in advance of my sounding that note, so that even now, as she bravely blinked under the signal of my word, I could keep her comparatively firm.
A talk? Do you mean she spoke?
It came to that. I found her, on my return, in the schoolroom.
And what did she say?
I can hear the good woman still and the candour of her stupefaction. That she suffers the torments. It was this of a truth that made her, as she filled out my picture, gape.
"Do you mean," she faltered, "of the lost?"
"Of the lost. Of the damned. And that's why, to share them, I faltered myself with the horror of it. But my companion with less imagination kept me up.
To share them?
She wants Flora. Mrs. Groves might, as I gave it to her, fairly have fallen away from me had I not been prepared. I still held her there to show I was. As I've told you, however, it doesn't matter.
Because you've made up your mind? But to what?
To everything.
And what do you call everything?
Why, sending for their uncle.
Oh, Miss In Petty, do!
My friend broke out. Ah, but I will. I will. I see it's the only way. What's out, as I told you, with Miles, is that if he thinks I'm afraid to, and has ideas of what he gains by that, he shall see he's mistaken. Yes, yes, his uncle shall have it here from me on the spot, and before the boy himself, if necessary. That if I'm to be reproached with having done nothing again about more school...
Yes, miss,
my companion pressed me. Well, there's that awful reason. There were now clearly so many of these for my poor colleague that she was excusable for being vague.
But, which?
Why, the letter from his old place.
You'll show it to the master?
I ought to have done so on the instant.
Oh, no, said Mrs. Groves, with decision.
I'll put it before him, I went on inexorably, that I can't undertake to work the question on behalf of a child who has been expelled.
For we've never in the least known what,
Mrs. Groves declared.
For wickedness. For what else when he's so clever and beautiful and perfect? Is he stupid? Is he untidy? Is he infirm? Is he ill-natured? He's exquisite! So it can be only that, and that would open up the whole thing. After all, I said, it's their uncle's fault if he left here such people. He didn't really in the least know them. The fault's mine.
She had turned quite pale.
Well, you shan't suffer, I answered. The children shan't,
she emphatically returned. I was silent a while. We looked at each other. Then what am I to tell him?
You needn't tell him anything. I'll tell him.
I measured this.
Do you mean you're right?
Remembering she couldn't, I caught myself up. How do you communicate?
I tell the bailiff. He writes.
And should you like him to write our story? My question had a sarcastic force that I had not fully intended, and it made her, after a moment, inconsequently break down. The tears were again in her eyes.
Ah, miss... You right.
Well, tonight, I at last answered, and on this we separated. 17. I went so far in the evening as to make a beginning. The weather had changed back, a great wind was abroad, and beneath the lamp in my room, with Flora at peace beside me, I sat for a long time before a blank sheet of paper, and listened to the lash of the rain and the batter of the gusts. Finally I went out, taking a candle. I crossed the passage and listened a minute at Miles's door. What, under my endless obsession, I had been impelled to listen for was some betrayal of his not being at rest, and I presently caught one, but not in the form I had expected. His voice tinkled out.
"I say, you there? Come in."
It was a gaiety in the gloom. I went in with my light and found him in bed, very wide awake, but very much at his ease.
"Well, what are you up to?"
he asked, with a grace of sociability in which it occurred to me that Mrs. Groves, had she been present, might have looked in vain for proof that anything was out. I stood over him with my candle. "How did you know I was there?"
"Why, of course I heard you. Did you fancy you made no noise? You're like a troop of cavalry."
He beautifully laughed. "Then you weren't asleep?"
"Not much. I lie awake and think."
I had put my candle, designedly, a short way off, and then, as he held out his friendly old hand to me, had sat down on the edge of his bed. "What is it," I asked, "that you think of?"
"What in the world, my dear? But you."
Ah, the pride I take in your appreciation doesn't insist on that. I had so far rather you slept.
Well, I think also, you know, of this queer business of ours.
I marked the coolness of his firm little hand. Of what queer business, Miles?
Why, the way you bring me up, and all the rest.
I fairly held my breath a minute, and even from my glimmering taper there was light enough to show how he smiled up at me from his pillow. What do you mean by all the rest?
Oh, you know, you know.
I could say nothing for a minute, though I felt as I held his hand and our eyes continued to meet that my silence had all the air of admitting his charge, and that nothing in the whole world of reality was perhaps at that moment so fabulous as our actual relation. "Certainly you shall go back to school," I said, "if it be that that troubles you, but not to the old place. We must find another, a better." How could I know it did trouble you, this question, when you never told me so, never spoke of it at all? His clear, listening face, framed in its smooth whiteness, made him for the minute as appealing as some wistful patient in a children's hospital, and I would have given, as the resemblance came to me, all I possessed on earth, really to be the nurse or the sister of charity who might have helped to cure him. Well, even as it was, I perhaps might help. "Do you know, you've never said a word to me about your school. I mean the old one. Never mentioned it in any way." He seemed to wonder. He smiled with the same loveliness, but he clearly gained time. He waited, he called for guidance.
"Haven't I?"
It wasn't for me to help him. It was for the thing I had met. Something in his tone and the expression of his face as I got this from him set my heart aching with such a pang as it had never yet known. So unutterably touching was it to see his little brain puzzled and his little resources taxed to play, under the spell laid on him, a part of innocence and consistency. "No, never. From the hour you came back. You've never mentioned to me one of your masters, one of your comrades, nor the least little thing that ever happened to you at school. Never, little Miles, no, never, have you given me an inkling of anything that may have happened there. Therefore, you can fancy how much I'm in the dark. Until you came out that way this morning, you had, since the first hour I saw you, scarce even made a reference to anything in your previous life. You seemed so perfectly to accept the present." It was extraordinary how my absolute conviction of his secret precocity, or whatever I might call the poison of an influence that I dared but half to phrase, made him, in spite of the faint breath of his inward trouble, appear as accessible as an older person, imposed him almost as an intellectual equal. "I thought you wanted to go on as you are." It struck me that at this he just faintly coloured. He gave, at any rate, like a convalescent, slightly fatigued, a languid shake of his head.
I want to get away."
"You're tired of Bly?"
"Oh, no, I like Bly."
"Well, then."
"Oh, you know what a boy wants."
I felt that I didn't know so well as Miles, and I took temporary refuge. "You want to go to your uncle?" Again at this, with his sweet, ironic face, he made a movement on the pillow.
"Ah, you can't get off with that."
I was silent a little, and it was I now, I think, who changed colour. "My dear, I don't want to get off."
"You can't. Even if you do, you can't. You can't."
He lay beautifully staring.
"My uncle must come down and you must completely settle things."
"If we do," I returned with some spirit, "you may be sure it will be to take you quite away."
"Well, don't you understand that that's exactly what I'm working for? You'll have to tell him about the way you've let it all drop. You'll have to tell him a tremendous lot."
The exultation with which he uttered this helped me somehow for the instant to meet him rather more. And how much will you, Miles, have to tell him? There are things he'll ask you. He turned it over.
Very likely. But what things?
The things you've never told me, to make up his mind what to do with you. He can't send you back.
Oh, I don't want to go back, he broke in. I want a new field.
He said it with admirable serenity, with positive, unimpeachable gaiety, and doubtless it was that very note that most evoked for me the poignancy, the unnatural, childish tragedy of his probable reappearance at the end of 3 months with all this bravado and still more dishonour. It overwhelmed me now that I should never be able to bear that, and it made me let myself go. I threw myself upon him, and in the tenderness of my pity I embraced him. Dear little Miles, dear little Miles! My face was close to his, and he let me kiss him, simply taking it with indulgent good humour.
Well, old lady?
Is there nothing, nothing at all that you want to tell me? He turned off a little, facing round toward the wall, and holding up his hand to look at as one had seen sick children look.
I've told you. I told you this morning.
Oh, I was sorry for him. That you just want me not to worry you. He looked round at me now, as if in recognition of my understanding him, then ever so gently.
To let me alone, he replied.
There was even a singular little dignity in it, something that made me release him, yet when I had slowly risen, linger beside him. God knows I never wished to harass him, but I felt that merely at this to turn my back on him was to abandon, or, to put it more truly, to lose him. I've just begun a letter to your uncle, I said.
Well then, finish it.
I waited a minute. What happened before? He gazed up at me again.
Before what?
Before you came back and before you went away. For some time he was silent, but he continued to meet my eyes.
What happened?
It made me the sound of the words in which it seemed to me that I caught for the very first time a small, faint quaver of consenting consciousness. It made me drop on my knees beside the bed and seize once more the chance of possessing him. Dear little Miles, dear little Miles, if you knew how I want to help you. It's only that. It's nothing but that. And I'd rather die than give you a pain or do you a wrong. I'd rather die than hurt a hair of you. Dear little Miles. Oh, I brought it out now, even if I should go too far. I just want you to help me to save you. But I knew in a moment after this that I had gone too far. The answer to my appeal was instantaneous, but it came in the form of an extraordinary blast and chill, a gust of frozen air, and a shake of the room as great as if in the wild wind the casement had crashed in. The boy gave a loud, high shriek, which, lost in the rest of the shock of sound, might have seemed indistinctly, though I was so close to him, a note either of jubilation or of terror. I jumped to my feet again and was conscious of darkness. So for a moment we remained while I stared about me and saw that the drawn curtains were unstirred and the window tight. "Why, the candle's out!" I then cried.
"It was I who blew it, dear," said Miles.
18. The next day, after lessons, Mrs. Groves found a moment to say to me quietly,
"Have you written, miss?"
"Yes, I've written." But I didn't add, for the hour, that my letter, sealed and directed, was still in my pocket. There would be time enough to send it before the messenger should go to the village. Meanwhile, there had been, on the part of my pupils, no more brilliant, more exemplary morning. It was exactly as if they had both had at heart to gloss over any recent little friction. They performed the dizziest feats of arithmetic, soaring quite out of my feeble range, and perpetrated, in higher spirits than ever, geographical and historical jokes. It was conspicuous, of course, in Miles in particular, that he appeared to wish to show how easily he could let me down. This child, to my memory, really lives in a setting of beauty and misery that no words can translate. There was a distinction all his own in every impulse he revealed. Never was a small, natural creature, to the uninitiated eye, all frankness and freedom, a more ingenious, a more extraordinary little gentleman. I had perpetually to guard against the wonder of contemplation into which my initiated view betrayed me, to check the irrelevant gaze and discouraged sigh in which I constantly both attacked and renounced the enigma of what such a little gentleman could have done that deserved a penalty. Say that, by the dark prodigy I knew, the imagination of all evil had been opened up to him. All the justice within me ached for the proof that it could ever have flowered into an act. He had never, at any rate, been such a little gentleman as when, after our early dinner on this dreadful day, he came round to me and asked if I shouldn't like him for half an hour to play to me. David playing to Saul could never have shown a finer sense of the occasion. It was literally a charming exhibition of tact, of magnanimity, and quite tantamount to his saying outright, "The true knights we love to read about never push an advantage too far. I know what you mean now. You mean that to be let alone yourself and not followed up, you'll cease to worry and spy upon me, won't keep me so close to you, will let me go and come. Well, I come, you see, but I don't go. There'll be plenty of time for that. I do really delight in your society, and I only want to show you that I contended for a principle." It may be imagined whether I resisted this appeal, or failed to accompany him again, hand in hand, to the schoolroom. He sat down at the old piano and played as he had never played, and if there are those who think he had better have been kicking a football, I can only say that I wholly agree with them. For, at the end of a time that under his influence I had quite ceased to measure, I started up, with a strange sense of having literally slept at my post. It was after luncheon, and by the schoolroom fire, and yet I hadn't really in the least slept. I had only done something much worse. I had forgotten. Where, all this time, was Flora? When I put the question to Miles, he played on a minute before answering, and then could only say, "Why, my dear, how do I know?" breaking, moreover, into a happy laugh, which immediately after, as if it were a vocal accompaniment, he prolonged into incoherent, extravagant song. I went straight to my room, but his sister was not there. Then, before going downstairs, I looked into several others. As she was nowhere about, she would surely be with Mrs. Groves, whom, in the comfort of that theory, I accordingly proceeded in quest of. I found her where I had found her the evening before, but she met my quick challenge with blank, scared ignorance. She had only supposed that after the repast I had carried off both the children, as to which she was quite in her right, for it was the very first time I had allowed the little girl out of my sight without some special provision. Of course, now indeed she might be with the maids, so that the immediate thing was to look for her without an air of alarm. This we promptly arranged between us, but when, 10 minutes later, and in pursuance of our arrangement, we met in the hall, it was only to report on either side that after guarded inquiries, we had altogether failed to trace her. For a minute there, apart from observation, we exchanged mute alarms, and I could feel with what high interest my friend returned me all those I had from the first given her.
"She'll be above," she presently said. "In one of the rooms you haven't searched."
"No, she's at a distance," I had made up my mind. "She has gone out." Mrs. Groves stared.
"Without a hat?"
I naturally also looked volumes. "Isn't that woman always without one?"
"She's with her. She's with her, I declared. We must find them. My hand was on my friend's arm, but she failed for the moment, confronted with such an account of the matter, to respond to my pressure. She communed, on the contrary, on the spot with her uneasiness.
And where is Master Miles?
Oh, he's with Quint, there in the schoolroom.
Lord, miss!
My view, I was myself aware, and therefore I suppose my tone, had never yet reached so calm an assurance. The trick's played, I went on. They've successfully worked their plan. He found the most divine little way to keep me quiet while she went off.
Divine?
Mrs. Groves bewilderedly echoed. Infernal, then, I almost cheerfully rejoined. He has provided for himself as well. But come. She had helplessly gloomed at the upper regions.
You leave him?
So long with Quint? Yes. I don't mind that now.